Broadcasting to New York City, Los Angeles, Chicago, Sydney, London, and around the world, this is Trumpet Radio Live.
Thanks for joining us here on Trumpet Radio 101.3 KPCG, online kpcg.fm, and a live link at thetrumpet.com. Coming up on today's edition of Trumpet Radio Live, a very historic weekend for Russell Westbrook of the Oklahoma City Thunder. We've got some details about that. If you like sports, you'll like some of these stories. Also, 10 middle-class jobs that might be disappearing. The job market's changing, and it might affect some listeners. And if you like sky watching, tonight's going to be a good night for you. There's some things you can see up there that are pretty special. That and more on Trumpet Radio Live.
This is Trumpet Radio Live.
Thanks for joining us here on Trumpet Radio Live at 101.3 KPCG, online at kpcg.fm. Live link at thetrumpet.com. You can follow us on Twitter at kpcgfm. And if you'd like to email us, you can do that. Comments at kpcg.fm. I'm Dwight Falk, Grant Turgeon, and Abraham Blondeau here today. Grant, the great return. You're over your disease.
Yes.
Excellent. You had flu or something?
Yeah, it's not good.
No, okay. We won't get into the sad details of that. But better news, we're all Thunder fans except for Abraham here. And you're just not a big basketball guy.
Yeah, no, that's a correct assessment.
Right. Russell Westbrook last night, he broke the triple-double record in unforgettable performance. Most triple-doubles ever in a season. He's averaging a triple-double for the season now. First guy since Oscar Robertson to do it. He's got the record for the most triple-doubles in a season. Scored 50 points last night, including the game-winning three at the buzzer. King for a day.
Yeah, that was the best part, was that it didn't come in a loss, an embarrassing blowout or anything like that. They were actually down by 13 with 3 or 4 minutes left, and they came back and won. He shot a three from almost half court at the buzzer to win the game.
It's going to be a great feeling to do that. And then, you know, I'm always a little worried, though, because they always go and celebrate with their teammates, and they all jump up in the air. And I'm always afraid they're going to land on their foot and sprain their ankle or something. That does happen sometimes where people are celebrating. That's when they get injured. But he was okay. But incredible performance. Even other NBA players are sending out their congratulatory tweets saying, you know, it's incredible what he's done. Triple-double, for those who don't know, it's 10 or more in three statistical categories. Typically, it's points, rebounds, and assists. Mm-hmm. You could get it with blocks, but very rarely do you see 10 blocks
or steals.
In a game. Yeah.
Somehow.
Right? Or, I mean, you could do a quadruple double, but that's pretty much unheard of. And so he has, 42 this year? Is that what it
right.
is? 42. And so many players only get one or two in their whole career, if even that. He's done 42 this year alone. So it's just been spectacular. So even though here in Oklahoma City, we had to withstand the loss of Kevin Durant, Russell Westbrook has had a season for the ages, so it's been pretty exciting.
Yeah, and it still seems like he has a lot of detractors, even after what he's done this year. A lot of people accuse him of padding his stats, but the facts are that they're 33-9, something like that, 34-9, whenever he gets a triple-double, and they're 13-25 whenever he doesn't.
Yeah, I've seen some sports commentators, and I think they have to be sort of controversial just to get people to listen. Yeah, but there's been a few that have made it out like, oh, anybody can get a triple-double. He's just padding his stats. No, not anybody. It doesn't happen very often. It's pretty rare. And so, I mean, even if you went out and said, my goal is to just get triple-doubles, very few people could do it. It's not like it's a given if you want to. It's hard to do. Just admit it.
Exactly.
So I just have a question here. Maybe a lot of people like me have it as well. For Russell Westbrook, is the reason he's getting all these, is it because the team, it's the way the team plays, but also he's just playing at a high level as well?
Well, it's part of it is because the team is not been great around him, but he is just a human dynamo. I mean, the assists and the points for a guard, not that unheard of, even though he's leading the league in scoring as well. So he's not just getting 10 points, he's getting 31 a game. But the rebounds, But if you've seen his athleticism, that's where he's getting. I mean, 10 to average more than 10 rebounds a game for a guard who's about 6'3", maybe. I've stood next to him, and he's not much taller than me. I'm 6'2", so we're real close. I saw him at Target. That's my claim to fame. And but anyway, so he's not a big guy. And getting 10 rebounds, that's the really probably most impressive part of it.
Yeah, we talk about the detractors. I've actually seen people compile these videos of him going to the basket and getting the rebound uncontested and stuff like that. People are just trying to take away from it in any way possible. They're not compiling all the rebounds where he takes the ball from Kristaps Porzingis right out of his hands, or he outjumps Rudy Gobert, these 7-foot giants. I mean, he literally is just outharding those people.
He plays at 100 miles an hour all the time, and it's fantastic to see, especially in a league today that in the NBA where guys rest, they won't play certain games because they just don't want to be hurt or they're tired or whatever. And to have a guy go out, and I've seen quotes from him, Russell Westbrook, where he has said that, you know, he feels like it's a blessing and a gift to be able to play, and so he's going to give it all he's got every time he steps out there on the floor. People respect that, even to the point where the last few games, the away crowds have been cheering his effort. I mean, just the effort. That's where those rebounds come from. It's effort. It's just out-hearting the other guy, like you said, Grant.
Yeah, and whenever the whole visiting arena, road arena, is giving him a standing ovation, he doesn't even smile. He still has a game to win. So he might put his hand up for a second, but he really is focused on winning the game at all costs.
Yeah, so it's great job. And any field, whether it's sports or anything, you see somebody really excel, it's exciting to see it, especially when it's a historical type of performance. So, but there's always detractors. I'm sure it's the same in any field. I'm sure, you know, back in Mozart's day, you'd had a few people that said, not that great.
Just not for me.
Yeah, he's cheating the system or something. But no, it's a pretty legendary performance, so that's neat to take a look at. Some news that wasn't good from over the weekend, the terror attack. Worshippers celebrating Palm Sunday were targeted by ISIS terrorists with suicide bombs. At least 27 people killed in Tanta, while a further dozen died in Alexandria earlier on Sunday. So that happened over in Egypt. They had footage of it. I don't know if you guys saw that or not.
Yeah.
Yeah, the explosions.
Yeah, it's just in the Coptic churches, the Christians living in those huge Muslim nations, they're probably already nervous, but it's always a, I think shameful that one nation attack or one people attack another on their holy days, their religious holidays, when they're trying to do what they believe is holy or sacred. Just puts an extra level of evil to it, I guess. But yeah, I think ISIS is doing anything to get some traction, since they are getting defeated pretty much on every front right now.
Yeah, there's that's, I guess, an added danger maybe, is that if they feel that they are losing or running out of time, they get more extreme maybe. Related to that, Israel shut the Egypt border after terror warning on Passover Eve. So they had some warnings there, and they shut the border. And so pretty bad situation over there. The video of they had surveillance footage of the people detonating the bombs. And, you know, they always warn you and say it's graphic. And it is, except it's just a big explosion. Like, you don't see anything. I think the pictures are probably more graphic in my estimation of the aftermath. But it is strange. You know, you see the person walking and you realize that person's about to do something. No one knows. And then there's a big explosion.
Yeah, that's just such a volatile region, and I'm really not surprised that there was an attack on Christians, really just targeting the minority religion over there. Just goes to show how dangerous it is in the region, but mostly especially for the people who have differing beliefs.
Yeah, and that does get back to that sort of argument that comes up. Is terrorism, is it religion-based? You know, people will argue that, but when you see attacks on specific religious groups in their churches on the days that they're keeping, then obviously there's a religious reason for it.
Yeah, well, I'm reading a book on the war in Iraq, and it goes through all the violence and from 2003 onward. And basically, since 2003, there hasn't let up since then, since basically Zarqawi and the Sunni, well, what would become ISIS there in Iraq, basically. They've been on the rampage since 2003. So that's 14 years They've been doing these types of things, killing thousands of people, tens of thousands of people, and they still haven't been stopped. And they've targeted Christians. They've targeted Shiites, other Sunnis, Americans, any other people who just get in their way. And they've done some of the most grisly crimes of the 21st century. And I think when you look at what they've done, and this is just one more strike against them, is that it's at some point the Western world needs to stand up, man up, and deal with them, because not only are Christians suffering, but other Muslims too, and all these other people are suffering because of we're not willing to invest the force and the power to eliminate them completely.
Yeah, so pretty dramatic scene over there in Egypt over the weekend. The Trumpet Daily Radio Show, make sure you listen for that, coming up here in a bit on KPCG. Also stop and check out thetrumpet.com, some of the headlines today. Iran's strategy to sabotage world trade, that's by Brent Noctegal, also related to that. Reuters, Iran increasing support for Yemen Houthis, and the King of the South. So you can check those out and other stories at thetrumpet.com. Speaking of Iran, they're them and Russia coming out against President Trump in the U.S. and having a joint statement warning the United States. And so Iran, and I mean, it's not like people didn't know that Iran and Russia were allies, but it's certainly obvious now they have a joint statement.
Well, yeah, I think it's interesting, too. I think Russia said the U.S. became or came within inch length of coming to war with Russia over the airstrikes in Syria. And I think this might help or allay people's fears that Trump is in Putin's back pocket, because Putin's obviously not happy with what Trump decided to do there last week.
Yeah, you know, you would think so. The rational mind would think so. I saw a headline today where one of the journalists for a particular network came out with a theory that potentially it's all set up to try to distract people from them working together. And that qualifies as news. I mean, that's a pretty dangerous path to go down, to just start opining, you know, well, what if, but maybe, well, based on what? I mean, everybody could say what if and maybe. That doesn't mean anything.
Yeah, I saw that report too, and the guy was just unbearably smug about it. And there's just a tragedy going on, and America finally responds with some force, which probably should have happened a long time ago. And here he is with his conspiracy theory and presenting it almost like it's a fact, or at least just trying to plant the seed so that people will start to believe that it's true, even if it's the farthest thing possible from the truth.
Yeah, all the talk about fake news these days, and then come out with something like that, that's just odd to me, and pretty dangerous, because where does that stop if you can just kind of make up something and see if it gets traction?
Well, and two, that I think there's a bigger implication of treason, because you think of all the people arrested by the United States for colluding with Russia over with their intelligence or selling secrets, whatever it be. They go to jail, they're disgraced, they have to flee the United States for fear of extreme punishment. So does it suggest the president of the United States is colluding with Putin? That's an act of treason, essentially, against the American people. And so, I mean, that's a serious accusation to make. And if it's false, then your career should be destroyed or ruined, because you just can't go around accusing the highest executive of the land for such actions.
Yeah, that's a very good point. So an interesting situation there, of course, with Russia and Iran and the U.S. and everybody in the mix.
Did you hear how Mr. Trump apparently just saw pictures of the children who were gassed in Syria, and that's what basically encouraged him to change his entire stance on Syria and actually intervene there? Because initially he wasn't going to either. It is nice to see someone have some compassion. There's a lot of talk about compassion now, and yet we don't see a whole lot of that put into action. Here's a case where he looked at it as a father and a grandfather, and he actually was incensed by the way that those children were killed.
Yeah, it is an interesting point just to think about the actual victims. I mean, the bigger powers are kind of deciding what to do and how to deal with Syria. But then on the ground level, or like say you have your media people with opinions and so forth, but then on the ground level, people are dying. children and others in just horrible, horrific ways. And the footage is out there for people to see. And it's good to remember that there are actual victims there and that apparently, to some extent anyway, moved the president's emotions and to do something about it. And I think most people supported that. Most nations did.
Yeah, well, I think only three nations didn't, Russia, China, and Iran, from what I've seen, and Syria.
Right, Syria, yeah.
Add the fourth, even though I don't think Syria is actually a functioning nation anymore.
No.
But yeah, I think the rest of the world saw it as a good thing, and that's one good thing about modern-day media, is that you can't hide war crimes anymore. You can't sweep them under the rug or destroy the evidence or anything, because they're recorded. There's images, there's videos for everyone in the world to see, and you can't run from justice if those images are circulating around the world.
Right. You know, that even goes back to Saddam Hussein. You know, there's always this debate now, did he have weapons of mass destruction, did he not? But there's plenty of footage of him gassing the Kurds. That's very infamous footage of them dying, being dead, like a whole town just laying there dead. How did that happen?
Yeah, I think it was 20,000 Kurds.
Yeah.
It was some thousand. I might have the number wrong, but something like that. And that's not just the only terrible things he did to people. I know he would put people in the wood chippers feet first if they send a message to their family or to people. I mean, that's the kind of monster he was. So weapons of mass destruction or not, he did deserve to be deposed. And perhaps the U.S. could have done it better or had a better strategy or whatever might be said, but he, at the time, he probably was the most evil man, one of the most evil leaders in the world. And so I think the U.S. had every right to depose him.
Well, and that's the frightening time we live in, is that there are, no matter who has them, there are weapons of mass destruction out there, whether it's chemical, biological, or actually nuclear weapons. And they could get into the wrong people's hands. I don't know that there is a right hand for those to be in, but certainly they could get into the hand of somebody like an Assad or ISIS, who would not think twice about using something like that. So that is the frightful time we're in. We don't tend to think of it a lot because we just kind of go about our business, but there is a real threat of that. Those weapons are out there, and somebody could get them and use them.
And it's almost like we've gotten to the point where the entire world accepts anything short of nuclear weapons right now. I mean, it seems like we're even okay with Iran getting nuclear weapons 8 years from now. But as long as it's not right now, as long as it's not nuclear weapons right now, we can watch people being gassed to death with chemical weapons, any other type of brutal torture or war crime, as is okay, as long as it's not imminent world extinction right now.
Yeah, and even Syria has just been pounded to bits, even with just regular bombing and warfare. Here's an interesting write-up from the Washington Post, something maybe a little different with some schooling here in the U.S. Scott Walker, he's the governor from Wisconsin. He wants Wisconsin to be the first state to stop dictating how much time kids should go to school. Pause for applause from the children, the cheering. Says if Wisconsin Governor Scott Walker has his way, the Badger State will become the first to stop requiring students in public schools to spend a minimum number of hours in class. They can decide for themselves, the schools can. And as long as they are doing well with what the kids are learning and so forth, he thinks that's fine.
Yeah, well, perhaps this will help schools become more efficient in learning. I really don't know. Although I do like the way schools are structured and they teach kids a regimen, and how you have to be on time. You have to do something you don't like. You have to be there for as long as you need to be there. You can't change that. I think that teaches kids a lot of valuable character lessons besides what they learn in school. So, well, I really don't know. I think that if the schools had some good ideas, I imagine most of them would probably keep pretty similar hours to what they already have, maybe. I don't know.
Yeah, the proposal here in Walker's new budget plan calls for ending the state's current minimum requirements, which is 437 hours for kindergarten, 1,050 hours for elementary school, and 1,137 hours for secondary schools, allowing school districts to do what they want in terms of seat hours for students, which I guess is how they define it, seat hours. No standing desks. They're going to be sitting. Districts and schools would then be judged on their state report cards, which are produced annually by the Department of Public Instruction, based largely on standardized test scores. during a recent visit to a school in Waukesha, and I do know how to pronounce that, to talk up his budget proposal. He said, "To me, the report card is the ultimate measure. It's not how many hours you were sitting in a chair." So I think that in some ways there's a good point there. But I do think, Abraham, you had a good point too, that a lot of what you learn in school is just the fact that you've got to go, you've got to make it to your classes on time, you've got to follow a structure, even though a lot of times you could probably get through the material quicker if you did it on your own or like in a different setting. But you do learn some other things along the way, some life lessons. So probably a balance there.
Yeah, well, I think, too, is the social aspect. If you change, I mean, not that public schools necessarily have a good social aspect to them nowadays, but nonetheless, you do learn a lot of life lessons and those sorts of things. So I think there is lots of room for reform in public schools. And maybe this is one such reform that could make a big difference. But I think if you break down the regimen and make it more like a college where students have so much freedom where they basically destroy themselves sometimes if they're not already have self-discipline because there's nothing else disciplining them to be there. Not that that might happen with this, but I don't know. I think this has to be careful not to enforce bad habits with kids instead of building good habits in them.
Some of the kids I went to high school with, they weren't following a minimum requirement. They didn't show up too often, actually. So, yeah, it's an interesting proposal. I think would be nice would be if they just maybe varied it a little bit. Because I know that when you're sitting there behind a desk for all those hours, you get a little just kind of, I don't know, ground down from it. It'd be nice to have I think particularly for guys, and I know you can do some of these programs, but where maybe you went and you did something a little different. It was still school, but it was like learning a skill or something like that. You could go work a job for a while or have an internship. We did that at our high school when we were seniors. If you had your requirements met, you could take half the day and work, which I did. I loved it. Thought it was a really good idea. I'd like to see more of that.
Yeah, some more practical ways to apply school, having a job half the day. It's also really important for the teachers to consider anything that is different from just sitting down and listening to a lecture for nearly an hour and taking notes. It breaks it up a little bit and does keep the students on their toes a little bit more, maybe even looking forward to the class a little bit more.
Yeah, the practicality of things, that's always sort of the the issue, because I remember when I was in college and I was working in the broadcasting field and taking some classes related to it, and it was always funny to see the divide between those two, like the sort of generalized theory versus the actual how do you do this. It was a really different world, those two. And in a lot of cases, I thought, wow, the stuff that they were teaching, it really wasn't that relevant compared to what you would actually do on the job. So some not always, but in some cases, there's a pretty big divide there.
Yeah, well, I guess, too, each employer does it differently. So you have to do what they want you to do, even if the school taught you something different. So it's good to have that foundation of knowledge, I guess. But basically, a lot of the times from what I've heard from people, when they get hired, they kind of throw out all that and learn how to do it from their boss anyway. And that's basically what they do. And sometimes down the road, the university knowledge comes in handy, but most of the time, if you show up at a job and you're willing to learn how to do it, you can do it.
Yeah. And there would obviously be some exceptions, such as like being a doctor.
Yes.
Things like that. I would think, but interesting new proposal there by Scott Walker from Wisconsin, maybe changing the amount of hours that kids would have to go to school. You guys ever wonder how much money does the middle class really need to get by? You guys are all 1%ers, so you don't know much about that.
That's true, yeah.
I'm in my ivory tower just casting stones at the people below.
How much do the peasants need? they say, according to a recent Gallup survey, most American families believe a family of four would need at least $58,000 a year to get by. That sounds about right.
Yeah, I think. Well, because growing up, I was middle class with my family. I still am middle class now, just for a disclaimer, but I think that's pretty fair because you have to pay for all the kids' fees, all the ravenous hunger of boys growing up. All these things just cost so much money. So
lessons and clothing and activities and et cetera, et cetera. And that's to get by. I mean, that's not like putting away a huge amount. They say that's more than the median household income, which came in at $55,775 a year in 2015. And it's more than double the federal poverty threshold of $24,000. So, but there is a bit of a disparity there, they say, between what government officials consider a living wage and what American families consider a living wage. And so they basically say it depends on where you live in the country. Families of four with two working adults, two children in the north need $69,273. In the west, you need $68,651. And in the south, $63,837. Midwest, $63,144. So it kind of depends on where you are. Depends on what your lifestyle, what you want to do, what your goals are for the future, those types of things. But anyway, that's about how much you need, $50,000-$60,000, somewhere in there.
That's a lot of money. That just shows you that maybe things are a little too expensive, and maybe also the idea of planning a family is very important too. We've heard a lot about raising minimum wages. How about just getting past that level of job before starting a family too? That's another way to take responsibility.
Yeah, and I think in a lot of cases they factor in two working adults. So, you know, two people making $30,000 a year, so you got your $60,000, but still. Then there's more expense because you've got to pay for your child care, and there's just the toll of being away from the home and that type of thing. So if you want to make that kind of money as one person mainly, the breadwinner, as it were. Can you say that anymore? Is that a thing?
Sexist?
Yeah, I don't know. But you have to have a little bit of a better job there. So like you say, you know, you don't want to put the cart before the horse and have the family responsibilities before you've got the income. But here's some news about middle-class jobs that they think might soon be gone because of the changing the way things are done. Number 10, bank tellers. They're thinking that job might go away. I could see that happening.
Yeah, well, I think 95% of all my banking, I don't need to talk to someone. There's always like loans and the bigger things you talk with someone behind a desk, but just go ATM, go online, and that's pretty much it.
That's right. Number 9, home economics teacher. I don't know why that one teaching is not, you know, it's not like teacher. It's home, very specifically home economics teacher. So maybe people don't want to learn about that.
My own
anymore.
Mother is going to lose her job.
depends on what school you're at. Number 8, travel agents. Yeah, do it yourself. Do it online. Number 7, printing workers, people that are doing pre-press and other types of things. I guess it's just not as big of a deal anymore. Not as many books, maybe, and publications. Number 6, I was surprised that this is even considered a middle-class job, parking enforcement workers. Go around and get people little tickets or whatever. I didn't know that was like a good job.
Is that like a branch of the police, maybe? Like one of the lower positions starting out?
It could be. I'm not sure how that works. I know in high school I got a couple tickets for parking because our parking lots were always full. And sometimes you had to get to class and you just bite the bullet and hope they don't see you, but they did.
Yeah.
They had to pay the piper.
I always get one. Oh, I got one at UCO because my pass expired when I was there, and so I got a ticket or something like that. But yeah, I guess that's just one job day. I don't see them around too often. And most of the time it's all automated.
Sure.
Like it's in the lot, and then you can get towed if you don't pay or at the meter. So
right.
It's mostly automated, or it's like the private owner takes care of it, I guess.
Right. Number 5, a job, 10 middle-class jobs that will soon be gone. Number 5, manufacturing jobs, even though some more have been coming back, but they're, a lot of it's becoming automated. Number 4, watch repairers. I didn't know that was even a big thing, but apparently people aren't looking for that as much. Number 3, this would impact people, postal service workers. You see them around quite a bit. That used to be a pretty good job, but they think that might be not much of a job in the near future. Number 2, I didn't even know this was a job anymore. Telephone and switchboard operators. I didn't even know people did that anymore.
There's a few payphones I've seen, very rarely. Maybe that is the only occasion. I don't know.
Yeah, I just think of the old black and white footage where the lady's on the phone and she keeps like changing all the wires at the local hub. But yeah, I didn't know that was a thing.
Yeah, there might be a few exceptions to that where it's smaller communities or I think some military organizations still use an antiquated system kind of like that for security reasons. But But yeah, it's so rare that I'm sure that they would go extinct anyway.
Yeah. Yeah, or maybe like a front desk where people call in, like, and then they just pass them through.
Right.
That happens in places. Maybe that's not needed. And number one, this one actually really interests me because I asked the other day, and I have wondered, like, how do they run those trains? Like, what do people do on those trains? The number one job that's going away is a job called locomotive firers. Sometimes they're called assistant engineers. They monitor equipment, watch for train signals, and look out for obstacles on the tracks. Back when freight trains ran with five-person crews, the job was more common, but as railroad companies have scaled back to two- or three-person crews, locomotive fire jobs have all but disappeared. In 2014, only 1,700 people in the country were still working as locomotive firers, and their numbers are expected to fall to 500 by 2024. That's how come I don't know anybody that works on the train. There's not very many of them.
Yeah, and the I guess a lot of systems becoming more automated and that sort of thing. It does did remind me, though, back in the turn of the 20th century, if you paid a few extra dollars, you could actually sit on the cattle clear, the thing at the very front of the train.
Really?
It had two chairs there. For a few extra dollars, you could sit on the very front of the train as it was going to the countryside, and it's the best view on there.
And the potential place to be killed.
Yes, yeah. If there was any obstruction on the tracks, you would be part of the, would become part of the obstruction. But yeah, I know Churchill did it a lot and other people traveling through Africa.
Wow. Well, that would be pretty neat to be on that, but then potentially, yeah, you could die.
Yeah. I mean, the trains weren't, they were only traveling 40 miles an hour. Like, so it's.
You die slowly.
Yeah. It's still fast, but it's not like train travel today.
Yeah. Get a bug hitch in the face or something.
Yeah.
That would sting. Yeah. Well, yeah, I guess if you were with somebody, you were on a date and you weren't all that interested in talking to him, you go out there.
Yeah.
Too much wind. You couldn't hear anything anyway. Here's a neat story, a little quick one for you. A lot about Wisconsin today for some reason. A Wisconsin couple has three sets of twins, all with the same birthday. Two of them are adopted, and then they had their own. And they all have the same birthday. Pretty amazing. February the 28th, all in different years.
Wow.
So that's not the leap day, right? Like when there's a leap year, it's
February 28th.
Is that, no, because that's February 29th or
29th, I think.
It's 29th.
Okay. Yeah. So I'm like, if they all had the birthday on like a leap year, that would even be more crazy. But
yeah.
Okay.
So they adopted two twins, two sets of twins, and they had the same birthday. I don't know if they planned that or that just the way it worked out. And then they end up having their own. Didn't think they could have any, and then had some medical help there, I guess, and had twins, and same day. So sort of unique. Nice little family story. They all live on a farm. They said it's pretty busy. A lot of kids running around.
Yeah, it must be an expensive February for them.
Yeah, so. That's right. Well, I guess, yeah, that probably is the case. You're listening to Trumpet Radio Live here on 101.3 KPCG. We're online at kpcg.fm. You can follow us on Twitter at kpcgfm. Also, email us any comments you have to comments@kpcg.fm. I'm Dwight Falk, Grant Turgeon, and Abraham Blondeau here today. Grant, interesting story here you've got. This is from thetrumpet.com. Ridiculed Vice President Pence's prudent policy. That's a lot of P's.
That's alliteration for you.
Yeah, it is.
That's an English tool.
Yeah. And so Vice President Pence has been getting some mockery and some ridicule because he's apparently a pretty upstanding guy.
Yeah, apparently it caused a fit of unrighteous indignation, according to Kieran Underwood, who wrote this. I just thought he wrote this in a really good way that exposed a lot of hypocrisy among basically the liberal media that has started to attack him for this. What Vice President Trump does is he makes sure he's not in a room alone with a woman. Oh, yeah, Vice President Pence.
Yeah,
Vice President Trump.
Who's running the show around here?
That's actually going to confirm a lot of their suspicions, too.
Right.
But, yeah, anyway, he won't have dinner alone in a room with a woman, and he won't go to parties where alcohol is served unless his wife is there with him. And that just sparked a lot of outrage. Personally, everyone I know does the same thing, so it's not really that odd to me.
Yeah, we live in an interesting society where if somebody is kind of going above and beyond, I guess as some would see it, in terms of trying to be faithful in their marriage and live an upstanding way, it can run into a little bit of backlash from the media in particular. And apparently that's happened here, according to this write-up from thetrumpet.com.
Right. And really the media is trying to paint him as someone who is like afraid of his inner sexual predator or something like that, where they think that, you know, he's concerned that he might just go crazy as soon as he's away from his wife. But really, it's a safeguard for marriage, which is a sacred institution. If you don't have things like that in place, that's when mistakes can happen.
Yeah, that's really really an interesting thing. He has some great quotes here in this article about some of what some of the media has said about him, to that same point about, well, clearly he's got some big issue because he's, you know, he's really working to stay on the other side or away from trouble. But, you know, the thing is, the Bible talks about even avoiding the appearance of evil. Just don't even get involved in something that looks bad if you can help it. And, you know, it is really interesting to see somebody in the public eye like this who I would say is aware enough of human nature to know that, okay, if I put myself in a bad situation, eventually something bad might happen. So I'm going to avoid the bad situation. Mm-hmm. As opposed, I mean, who out there can just throw themselves into really, you know, situations that could turn bad and never once have an issue with it? It doesn't happen.
Well, that just shows you basically the fundamental misunderstanding of human nature that's going on here. That's what Kieran Underwood brings out as well. I don't know if maybe people just trust themselves too much to apply a rule like this, but surely a lot of people who have made a mistake in this area would have wished that they had a policy like Mr. Pence has had. And also, if you just look at the fruits, look how great the Pence marriage is. It really is a fantastic thing. His wife is even called a prayer warrior by those who are close to her. And she was even consulted by Mr. Trump as a candidate back before he was president, because he knew that she had a lot of input on Mr. Pence's decisions as well.
Well, I was thinking, you know, an interesting way to think about this same sort of principle of avoiding a bad situation. Would anybody want to move their family next to a known drug house and say, like, ah, it'll be fine. We you know, we're not involved in that, but we're going to live right next door to it. No, you'd want to get out of there as soon as possible. Or would you just, you know, want to walk through a part of town where you know people get murdered in the middle of the night? Like, ah, no big deal. Of course not, because there's imminent danger.
Right.
There's a threat of something bad happening, even though you may not be interested in looking for it. It might come find you. And so even in that, I think that sort of principle obviously applies to everything. Stay away from the bad situations.
Yeah, that's the kind of flawed mindset of it would never happen to me. And that's what I'm sure people think anytime some sort of a freak accident comes up in the news, anytime, you know, hundreds of people are murdered in a terrorist attack, we would think, well, you know, that's never going to hit so close to home. It applies to every single personal decision we make as well. If we sort of just trust ourselves too much, we trust our human nature so much, that's when mistakes happen. And Kieran Underwood also points out a lot of hypocrisy here. Remember how righteous and upstanding the media tried to make themselves look when Mr. Trump's comments about women came out.
True.
On that tape 11 years ago or 12 years ago. They thought that his comments were appalling. They thought that his locker room talk was just something that really does scar every woman and girl in the entire country. And yet when Mr. Pence is taking precautions to make sure he doesn't take advantage of any women or cheat on his wife in any way, he is also seen as a sexist. So either you say lewd things and are a sexist, or you do everything possible to avoid mistreating women and you're also a sexist. If you're not on their side, that's how you're viewed.
Yeah, I think there were some that even said that some of those comments that were recorded that President Trump made, like, should disqualify him from holding the office. And so here on the other side, like you say, you have the vice president who is really seems to be pretty upstanding and going above and beyond, and he can't win either. Mm-hmm. So it's kind of tough to win those situations.
Right. And there's also a critic brought out in this article who said that if you really want to cheat on your wife in this age, technology is available. You wouldn't have to meet alone with a woman. the whole point is he doesn't want to cheat on his wife. I don't think, maybe that's not registering with these people. He doesn't want to cheat on his wife. He wants to have a faithful marriage. That's exactly why he is not, leaving himself in these situations where there could be some trouble.
Yeah. Well, that's really a good example, and that should really be praised in a lot of ways. But I think one of the reasons it's not is because I think there's a lot of guilt in, society, because society doesn't live that way. Yep. for the most part. A lot of people do. Not to say that there aren't people that do, but unfortunately, a lot of people do not, and especially those that are more in the limelight. Usually, the stories aren't positive ones.
Right. I mean, that is really a common sin today. I heard on the radio a couple of years ago. At the time, there were 47,000 people just in Oklahoma City registered on one of these affair websites, adultery websites. And so it just shows you, even in a religious area like this, there are a lot of sins that people are into that they would never want anyone to know about, obviously.
Yeah, it's a bad situation. And like was brought out, the technology can make it very difficult for some people. So have to avoid those things. That's a really good write-up. At thetrumpet.com. Ridiculed Vice President Pence's prudent policy. wipe the spit away from the radio there. But that is really interesting. It's good to see somebody in the public eye that's doing things good for now anyway. I over the years, there's been different people that have been a little more conservative that way, or at least made a show of it in some ways, and then they did get caught with something, unfortunately. And I just remember the media having a field day. They love that. Oh, you were the big one to say none of this, and now you do it. So they really are being watched under a magnifying glass.
Yeah, I think it's also important to realize in Mr. Pence's case, he's not going around trumpeting this.
Right.
He wasn't trying to brag about it. It got found out because someone wrote a feature story about his wife, and it was mentioned in passing, and yet a lot of people seized on this one paragraph in the entire article and are trying to blast them for maybe being holier than thou. They were not trying to proclaim this to the entire world, in which case maybe some backlash would be a little bit more justified.
Yeah, if they were making a big thing out of it, but just trying to live a good way, and that's a good thing to see. And you can read more about that at thetrumpet.com as well. Abraham, you've got it right up here for us. For the people that like watching the sky, my son has a telescope. It's not a great one by any means, but we can't figure that thing out to save our life.
It's impossible.
I'm like, why is this so hard? I just can't figure this thing out. I'm so bad. So we went back to the binoculars. This is from space.com. Hubble telescope. Sky watchers prep for spectacular views of Jupiter tonight.
Yes. Yeah, tonight is pretty excited if this is your thing. And Jupiter will be near its closest point to Earth for all of 2017. It's basically when Jupiter is in a straight line with with the Sun and Earth. So it will be really bright on the horizon and will be in the opposite side of the sky to where the Sun is. So when the Sun's setting, Jupiter will be coming over the horizon. And so Jupiter is the biggest planet, so it will be really bright in the sky. And so people will be able to see it there over the horizon. But also this gives a great chance for Hubble telescope to take some pictures of it and get some pictures of it that we've never seen before because it's so close. And so scientists are really excited about this because they're really going to focus on the red storm on Jupiter and also take some pictures of its planets and that sort of, or of its moons, excuse me, and just get some better pictures.
Yeah. Is it just tonight or is it for a few days?
It will be tonight's its where its closest mm-hmm. point, but I imagine for the next week or so it will be observable in a better way. What was really interesting, I thought I never knew this, the red storm, the red dot there on Jupiter, the first time it was observed was in the 1800s with very crude telescopes. But that storm, it's been lasting for over 200 years.
Wow.
It's also bigger than Earth.
Yeah.
So the Earth could fit inside of that red storm on the Jupiter. So I never knew it was that big before. But it will help. They're trying to figure out why the storm exists, what causes it, why it's been going on for so long. And so it's been getting smaller over time, but it's still there. And so that'd be really fascinating because Jupiter, the whole surface is covered by clouds and gases. And so it'd be fascinating to find out on other planets why these storms happen and that sort of thing. So hopefully Hubble can take some really good pictures of it and we can get some more detail.
Yeah, you can imagine being a weatherman up there.
Yeah.
Forecast. probably stormy. It'd be stormy again. I was thinking, that, you know, maybe they've already done this, but there's a couple, at least one. There's Jupiter, Florida. That's the name of a town. You have a sports team, you call yourself the Red Storm. That's the Jupiter true. Red Storm? Would that not be cool?
It's very cool.
They probably already have that, but that would be an awesome idea.
Yeah, and the mascot can just be this big red sphere of swirling around.
Yeah. We're going to last for hundreds of years, and we're bigger than Earth. That would be a pretty epic sports team.
So I think they do have a minor league baseball team, but they should change their name if it's not that already.
That would be really, really good. And then, because, you know, kids would always be like, Dad, why do they call him the Red Storm? And you'd either be like, I don't know. Or you would know, and then you could teach them something about Jupiter. So you could learn something.
Wow, this shows us an idea factory.
It really is.
But one other thing they're going to do is they're going to look at Europa, which is one of its moons, and see if it can sustain life. And inevitably, they're going to find out it can't. But nonetheless, Europa is interesting because it appears there's water on it or something like it. And so they've been observing that for decades, really trying to figure out if they could establish life there. But in any event, not that anyone would want to live that close to Jupiter. But in any event, it is interesting that on that huge gas planet, there are moons with water, appears water and stuff on them. So
yeah.
It is interesting that on that moon, it's one of the few places where they found H2O.
It's really neat. They're not going to find any life forms out there, obviously. But I would say it would be funny if they did find it, but it looked just like suburbia here.
Right, it looks the same.
They took a shot of it. It was just people barbecuing and going to the mall. They're like, oh, wow. Yeah. Wow, they're just like us.
That's where all the Nickelback fans went to. Like, that's where you guys went.
That's a Canadian dig from Abraham.
Ouch. Yes. Yeah.
So, wow.
That's cold.
I didn't think anyone liked Nickelback anymore. Isn't that
I have no comment. I don't know.
Okay.
Don't know.
Just my generation then. So.
Who would have thought? You start talking about Jupiter being visible and ends up with Nickelback. Amazing.
I can tie it all together.
You can see that this evening and probably for a few evenings. But tonight will be the best night to go out and view Jupiter. I always like it when I hear those things in the news. I kind of like it and I kind of don't because I've had times where I've gone out to try to see something and I can't find it.
Right.
I get frustrated. I'm like, why can't I see it? and then somebody will say, like, oh, did you see it last night?
Yeah.
No.
Where were you looking? I saw the entire sky.
Yeah. I saw a plane, I think, flying. But should be able to see this tonight. And you said it'd be in the east, right? Because it'd be the opposite of the sun.
Yes.
So it'll...
Yeah, it's close to what star? It's close to the brightest star in the solar system. So if you know where that is, then you can find it easily. But basically, it should be one of the brightest celestial bodies up there. So that should be the best point of reference I can give you anyway.
Yeah, well, that'll be neat. Some people really, really get into that and like seeing those things. And I like to see something that's obvious, you know, like the different things that are up there. What are they, the constellations or whatever?
Right.
They say, yeah, that looks like a bull or something. I'm like, I don't see it.
Looks like a square.
Yeah.
So like, how is that? They have like some it's a moose or a, well, not maybe not a moose, but a bear is that kind of
the
thing.
Bear. Yeah.
Oh, yeah. It just looks like a box.
Who would
like,
have thought that was a bear? Yeah.
Yeah.
Centaur, half man, half horse.
Yeah. Well, of course that one's pretty obvious. But so you can see Jupiter tonight. The other actually was Friday night. They had, I don't know if you guys saw them, went out and saw the moon at all. It was really bright. A double like ring around it. You ever see that?
Yeah, I forgot what those are called, but yeah, I guess when the atmosphere's right, you can see it.
Yeah, it's pretty neat. Yeah, I Googled it. I said, why is it, what is this? And basically it had to do with ice crystals, I guess, in the sky
right. And
the way that it refracted the light. So it's kind of cool. Neat to see. You've got a historical note for us, too. Sunday was the 100-year anniversary of the Battle of Vimy Ridge. Said that correctly?
Yes.
Vimy, yeah. And that has some significance for Canada in particular.
Yeah, this is probably Canadian history. A lot of people who aren't Canadians probably have never heard of the Battle of Vimy Ridge before. Or...
Nickelback is Canadian, by the way.
Yes. Oh, don't worry, I'm aware.
You're aware of that?
Yes. Moving past Nickelback. Battle of Vimy Ridge, a lot of, in Canadian history, it's almost sacred. it's viewed as, a lot of people view it as, when Canada became its own nation. And Vimy Ridge was a battle during World War One, where Vimy Ridge was considered an impregnable bastion of German strength on the Western Front. And for 32 months, the Allies had not had a good victory. The Battle of the Somme had been a bloody mess. Ypres, Passchendaele, at Verdun, the French, over a million men died, French and Germans combined there. So just huge casualties, no success. It was very depressing time in terms of how the war was going. You had also had the Dardanelles disaster. And so the Battle of Vimy Ridge was part of the Arras offensive, as ARRAS. That's a place in France. And Vimy Ridge was also the first time when the Canadian Corps fought together. So the four Canadian divisions in France fought as one unit. And they were able to capture Vimy in a matter of about 4 days. About 3,500 were killed, 10,000 casualties. So very light, considering it was something that the French thought was impossible. The French had lost 150,000 men a year before trying to capture Vimy. And so it's at this moment that a lot of people think Canada separated from Britain officially, where the Canadian troops on their own performed and took over this unconquerable obstacle on the Western Front, and they became their own people. And so I think what's also interesting is it happened about 50 years after Canada became a nation in 1867. So Canada was a part of the British Empire, so it was kind of a dominion, but it was didn't really have any recognizable characteristics yet. It did, but not on a world scale. People, when they thought of the British Empire, they still thought of Canada. Canada wasn't a household name. That all changed after Vimy and during World War One. When Canada came out of that war as its own nation, where people said Britain and Canada fought in the war. And so as a Canadian, it holds special significance because, as even one general said, as the battle took place, he saw a nation being born because he saw the Canadians achieving something no one else could.
It's interesting, isn't it, that most cases, nations are born out of warfare. They're not like born out of good times.
Yeah.
I don't know every instance, obviously, but just trying to think about it, in most cases, you have to fight your way to establish something. And then typically when you lose it is when you stop fighting, when you get lax and lazy and rich and increased with goods, I guess.
Yeah. Well, exactly. I mean, warfare, as many people put it, is the story of mankind. And so many of the high and low points are warfare. And that's really when a nation's character is tested, is during war. That's when the best and the worst of human character is on display. And so that's really the battleground, is where a nation defines who it is, whether it's has a quality of character to win the battle, to be victorious, or whether it succumbs to the aggressor. And so for Vimy, that's when Canada proved it was a nation that could defend itself, that could fight with the German army, which was considered to be invincible. And so that's true with any country. Agincourt for the British is really when they define them, I think, as a people who fight against odds. For America, it was the American Revolution, D-Day, Battle of the Bulge. All those battles are household names in America. Every American kid knows about them because that's to help define the American character is different from everyone else's. And that's the same phenomenon is true with Vimy Ridge for Canada. And although Canada has played a much smaller role in the world, in the world wars and everything, it still had a pretty significant contribution. And it is an important day. 100 years ago is when Canada really became independent from Britain, and it defined its own character, its own identity, separate from the British Empire, but still proud of being a British dominion.
Did they do anything special to mark the 100-year anniversary?
Yes. Yeah, there were several, pretty much across Canada, there were several celebrations in France. Justin Trudeau, Francois Hollande, and Prince Charles were all there at Vimy Ridge, I believe, for the ceremony. On Vimy Ridge itself, there's a memorial. Actually, when the Germans conquered France, Hitler, of all the war memorials, Hitler liked that one the most. He thought it was the most artistic for what that's worth. But anyway, it's still standing there today after it was built in the 1920s. And on the ridge itself, there's a pair of boots for each Canadian that was killed.
Oh, wow.
So there's 3,598 pairs of boots, empty boots there, with a red poppy on them.
Wow. Well, that's really interesting. 100-year anniversary there of the Battle of Vimy Ridge. One last note for today's program. This is kind of just an odd story. I want to tack it on at the end. A difficult one, too. Journalist discovers husband was killed in car crash as she delivers news on live TV. She's delivering the news of a car crash and then realizing as she's talking about it that it was actually her husband that was killed.
No way.
Yeah. And went on, she continued to read the news for 10 minutes. And then after that, you know, when they had a break, she broke down. She's a pro.
Yeah.
Wow.
Amazing.
Yeah, it's a high amount of professionalism to keep doing her job even when that happens.
Probably just kind of going to autopilot sort
yeah.
of. Yeah.
Yeah. Especially when everyone's watching you, you still have to do your job, I suppose, even though no one would fault her for not doing it.
Yeah. A senior editor at the news station said the staff learned that her husband was dead while she was reading the news, but they said they didn't have the courage to tell her. You just don't know how somebody would respond. But, yeah, that's pretty amazing. I've never heard of anything like that happening before, but I suppose it could.
Yeah.
It was in India, IBC 24. So they have footage of it, but it's not in English, so it's hard to totally get the impact of it, I suppose, if you don't speak the language from there. But, yeah, those things happen. Amazing. It's just, I thought that was really an odd thing. Anyway, kind of an interesting note. And the fact that she could go on for 10 minutes is pretty amazing. So, anyway. It's just kind of an interesting one to end on there. A little bit of a downer, I guess, but I thought it was a fascinating story, and I wanted to get it in before we got out of time today. You were checking something, Grant. Were you looking to see if Jupiter had a Red Storm sports team?
I think they're actually called the Hammerheads.
Ah!
So, pretty cool name still.
It is a cool name, and by the way, for Tim Tebow fans out there, he's playing minor league baseball for, I think it's the Fireflies.
Right.
South Carolina.
Yeah.
And he's hit 2 home runs already. So they're selling tickets. They're making money. People want to come see Tim Tebow.
Such a cute team name, the Fireflies. Just completely harmless, completely unimposing.
Yeah, that's right. Some teams are more intimidating. That's why I like the idea of like the Red Storm, because it sounds terrifying.
Right.
The Fireflies. You're like, you know, you catch them and put them in a jar. The kids play with them on those nice summer evenings. But
that's anyway. An easy win for the other team.
It's an easy win for the Fireflies, or against the Fireflies. Red Storm always beats the Fireflies. That's all the time we have for today on Trumpet Radio Live. Thanks for spending some time with us. For myself, Dwight Falk, Grant Hurch, and Abraham Blondeau, have a great rest of your day, and we'll talk to you again soon.
Listening to Trumpet Radio 101.3 KPCG.